Welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farrand, owner of the company Horns of Odin. And before we get into the show, I have to give a shout out to all our patrons and just give them an extra special thank you for supporting the show, because literally without them, we wouldn't be able to keep making the podcast. We have a whole team behind the scenes, and it's literally their support that helps us keep going and keeps those people in a job. So if you can support the show, it starts from £3 a month. That's literally 10p a day. You get a bonus episode every week, and that's where we do a Q&A with each guest every week, and you can submit your questions either before or during the show, as you can watch in the live chat. You get ad-free episodes. You get early access to all the episodes. You can watch all the episodes live, like I said before, and get the live chat. It's always a lot of fun. So you get the episode live, you get to see us, but there is also a third wall there, which is extra fun, which is the live chat, which goes on during the shows. And they're always wonderfully chaotic, to say the least. And you also get the NMP Discord server. And in there, it's a lovely little community of people just like you who are interested in this stuff, like the podcast. And it's a really nice group of people. And then the tier up from that, you get the story time episodes with myself and Jonas Lorentzen, which again are quite chaotic. We tend to have a drink, look through the sagas, and yeah, they are quite relaxed, and they're a really good laugh. If you haven't listened to those, we do put some of those up for free. So just go over to wherever you're listening to this right now, and you can probably listen to one of the story times on there and check it out. And like I say, we really do appreciate it. And if you can't support Patreon, and often obviously not everybody can, even just leaving us a 5-star rating or a positive review wherever you get your podcasts helps just bump us up in the rankings, helps new people find the podcast, and then maybe they can support. So any and all support is appreciated. But now let's get into the show. And today I'm joined by Amina Otto, who is also a student of the great and powerful Matthias Nordvik. So there's absolutely no pressure there for you, Amina, today.
Hi, everyone. I'm Amina Otto, former student, kind of continuing student of Matthias Nordvik.
We're all students of Matthias for life,
really,
I feel.
We really are. You can never get out of it. I met him when I was doing my undergrad at CU Boulder. I recently completed my MPhil at the University of Cambridge in Anglo-Saxon, Norse, and Celtic, and now I'm doing a second master's, an MSc in Celtic Studies at the University of Glasgow in Scotland.
So are you in Glasgow now?
I am. This is what Glasgow University accommodations looks like.
Why did I think you were in Oxford?
Ew.
I don't know why I thought you were in Oxford.
I don't know why I thought that either.
I mean, a little bit. If you're in Glasgow and you can't call Oxford, ew. Sorry to anybody from Glasgow, but
I'm from Cambridge, so.
Oh, maybe Cambridge is where I was thinking.
That's even more offensive.
Oh, fuck. I'm getting it all wrong. Oh. But the one time I went to this actually might sum Glasgow perfectly. The one time I went to Glasgow, I was driving to the Airbnb, and down this little side street, there was a giant fox sat in the middle of the street.
Yeah,
but this fox, yeah, he was big, and he was like, fuck you, I'm not moving for your car. He just sat there and looked at me, and no matter how close I got up to him, he was just like, nah, it's all right. This is where I'm sitting. So I had to like go up on the curb to go around him. And I feel like that's the most Scottish or Glaswegian fox that there ever could be.
I think so. Yeah, that sounds like it. They have been making tons of noise all summer and making their presence known.
Mm-hmm. And so the noise is terrifying as well.
Awful. It can be anything from barking puppy to murder victim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if anybody hasn't heard a fox scream, I think it's like a thing, isn't it, in New York, where so many fox screams get called in as like murder victims, or at least usually women being attacked.
Mm-hmm. I've heard in other places as well where their populations are particularly strong, it happens. But mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm in Glasgow now, enjoying the cloudiness and screaming foxes.
And your lovely student accommodation.
My lovely student accommodations that look sort of like a prison cell. You just can't see any of the good bits of it. You can't see all my bookshelves.
You did see, well, you showed me the pile of research books you brought with you in case.
So I'm very ready. It's two versions of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, or two translations, and then one book about the chroniclers themselves.
Mm-hmm. Which we are going to start with. But I guess that's kind of what we're going to look at is what the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles are, which you told me earlier was a dangerous question.
It is a dangerous topic. So I guess today we'll be looking at the formation of English identity as it pertains to the Viking presence in England, which is a huge topic. But the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle is a great place to start.
I feel like I've heard of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles a lot.
Probably have. It's often talked about in the same milieu as the Venerable Bede, his work, which was quite a bit earlier than the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. And even earlier than that was the writing of Gildas, who was a Briton during the invasion of the Angles, the Saxons, and the Utes. So if you think of it as kind of a few generations of history writing, it would go Gildas, which inspired Bede's writing, which formed the basis for a lot of the earlier entries for the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle.
Okay.
So
what is it its own
it's,
complete set of writing?
It's complicated.
Well, there we go. It's a good way to start.
So right now, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle is 7 manuscripts and 1 or 2 fragments, depending on who you talk to. They are categorized alphabetically from in order of when they stop chronologically. So manuscript A is the oldest one. It's the Parker Chronicle that's held in Corpus Christi College in Cambridge. And that is, the whole project was compiled under the court of King Alfred at the end of the 9th century. So around 892 is when we think they started compiling it. And all of the manuscripts have the same entries from when they arbitrarily chose to start recording history, which was 60 BC when Britannia was discovered by Rome, up until about 892. So that's the same across all the manuscripts, all 7 of them, and it's known as the common stock. And then after about 892, it gets really messy because you have different things being recorded differently in different places. So, like the Parker Chronicle focuses heavily on Wessex and its regnal line, so like King Alfred and his descendants. And then the other ones focus more on Mercia or more on, there's a bit called the Northern Recension, which talks a little bit more about what was going on in Northumbria at the time. So there are different geographical influences on all the manuscripts, which makes it really hard to form a cohesive picture of what was going on.
Okay, that's answered one question for me straight away, because I naively just assumed the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles were one individual book.
Nope. It is kind of misleading to talk about it as a chronicle. It's more, some scholars refer to it as Anglo-Saxon Chronicles, plural, which is probably more accurate, but also annoying.
Okay, so put it into my simple little mind, it is a collection of chronicles from the different kingdoms or areas
different regions.
Why is kingdoms not right? I've seen The Last Kingdom. Are they not all kingdoms? Was it not a kingdom of Mercia and a kingdom? Don't put your head in your hands like that.
Everyone asks me if I've watched The Last Kingdom, and I say I spend enough time in 10th century England. Why would I do that in my leisure time? But so yes, there were 4 main kingdoms. There was Wessex, Mercia, Northumbria, and East Anglia. And the reason it's called The Last Kingdom is because Wessex was the last independent Anglo-Saxon kingdom that hadn't been overtaken by the Vikings at that time. So, you know, by the end of the, I don't know when the series starts, but pretty much by the end of the 9th century, it was looking pretty grim for England.
Does Wessex ever get taken?
Not really. So they try to, short answer, No.
Okay.
Not to my knowledge, but my knowledge kind of peters out in the mid 10th century. They pretty much managed to beat back the Viking forces in massive campaigns under Alfred's predecessor, Alfred, and Alfred's successor, Edward the Elder. So they engaged in this really interesting military tactic that utilized reinforced towns, and they were called burghs. And they're recorded in a document called the Burgle Hidage. And by the main issue that they had against in fighting the Vikings was that the Vikings were very mobile. But by reinforcing these towns all over the English-held England or the Anglo-Saxon-held England, they were able to keep any territory that they won back because they could have reinforcements at those towns, they could have supplies at those towns. The idea was that none of them would be further than a day's ride from at least one other burg.
Okay.
So that sort of helped them mitigate the Vikings' ability to move very quickly and with great spontaneity. So they were able to go, get messages that the Vikings were attacking such and such a place in the Mercia and Wessex border. And within a day, they were able to confront them and successfully battle them. And then reinforce whatever burg they had managed to take back, or establish a burg and land that they had managed to take back, and keep the Vikings from retaking it.
Okay, is a burg just a bruh, bruh?
Yeah, a burg.
And so yeah, as in, because obviously we have tons of them off the top of my head, like
Here. Yes.
Knaresborough, Middlesbrough,
Yep, that's exactly
Edinburgh.
it. Yep, Edinburgh. So,
But that's
burg
spelled different,
means,
though.
it just means town. Really, it's like a very loose translation of town, or I don't know. I'm not a linguist, so don't come for me too hard if I'm wrong. But basically, just like a place where people live.
Yeah.
It could be anything from like a reinforced London to a tiny little hamlet with a fort that had a wall around it and some supplies in it. So there was a huge range to what they could look like, but the use of burgs was really important in the fight against the Vikings during that time. And that's kind of how Wessex managed to keep itself from being overwhelmed and how they managed to regain a lot of Mercia and some of East Anglia.
They didn't really do that in the Last Kingdom, though. I think
What did he do in the last kingdom?
Uhtred just kind of did it on his own, I think. I think he just kind of went out there and killed some people, killed a few like important people, and then was like, no, this is my land now. And I think he just kind of went like
First
that.
of all, the character Uhtred is about 100 years dislocated from the character, from the actual historical person that inspired him.
Oh,
So
so there was an actual person.
there was an Uhtred of whatever he is, Bamberg, Bamberg,
Bebember.
Bebenbe.
Do the accent if you want. Uhtred, son of Uhtred.
Yeah, I think he was about a century after all this was going on.
Okay. Yeah, I think. I feel like Bernard Cornwell did. He made an interesting story from history and kind of tried to keep somewhat accurate, but I think with that stuff you always have to take an artistic
Absolutely.
license.
I have no pro historical fiction is amazing. Take all the liberties you want to. I actually used a few images from The Last Kingdom in a presentation I gave about Edward the Elder, and it
Oh,
was
did
really
you?
cool.
Didn't even watch the show and you used the images,
I
eh?
did, yes.
Oh, how dare you?
But it was because I was talking about Edward's cousin, Athelstan, I think it was Athelstan, who tried to stage a coup as soon as Edward took the crown after Alfred's death. And the actor that they got to play him had such a punchable face. And the actions of this guy were pretty deplorable. So it went very well with the with the whole narrative of
Okay.
the conflict between Edward and Athelstan.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is Athelstan technically the first king of England? Is that right?
Different Athelstan. Athelward staged a coup once Edward inherited the crown from Alfred because his father, Athelward's father, Alfred's brother, was king before Alfred. Alfred took the throne after he died, and Ethelward thought that the crown should go back to him after Alfred's death instead of going to Alfred's son, Edward. So okay. What he did is he basically just got a bunch of his allies, kidnapped a nun, took over this little, estate, essentially, and holed up there. And he said, I will either live here or die here. And Edward's like, well, you just get out of here. I'm king. So Ethelward lets the nun go and leaves. And he goes to, allegedly, according to the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, he goes to the Vikings in Northumbria, and they accept him as king. And then nobody hears from him for about 2 years. Then he shows up in Essex with a whole ship army. And in a couple sources that are kind of later interpretations of what's happening in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, he's referred to as a pagan king, or king of a Viking king, essentially, just not English anymore. Mm-hmm. And he raids throughout Edward's land in Mercia, and Edward comes and confronts him, and they end up defeating him in battle and killing a bunch of high-ranking English people that were also turncoats. So,
as you do,
everyone has that one cousin.
As you do, yeah.
They might stage a coup.
There's always one at every family party.
Always one.
Yeah, usually it doesn't end up in maybe kidnapping a nun. But
yeah, that was that's just such a weird little detail. They were really upset about it in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle.
Oh, I imagine. Okay, so we now know what the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles are. Yes. So how do they kind of tell us, or how do we then get English identity? Because that's what I'm here for. I want to know how I ended up as an Englishman and not Anglo-Saxon anymore, I guess, or a Mercian.
Right. That's a really good question, because you would think that because Wessex was the most prominent kingdom during all of this, you would be called something like Saxons or Saxish. But the name English kind of comes from outside of England, because all of the Latin speakers, like the people writing in the clergy and the ecclesiastical communities on the continent, referred to the Anglo-Saxons as Angli, which was just a word that had been used by someone and it got recorded. And that just became the common term for the English, even though that was a bit of a reductive term. But they didn't really know that there were such distinct kingdoms in England. They just knew it was an island somewhere to the north. And so they wrote about the Angli, and that's why it became the English instead of the Saxish or Saxons or Saxony. But okay. The way that identity formation manifests in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle is sort of linguistically and sort of contextually. So they do make very important distinctions by saying where things happened. So things happened in Wessex, things happened in East Anglia or Mercia or Northumbria. They make really stark distinctions between the raiding Vikings and, to some degree, the settled Vikings as well, who, once they converted to Christianity, were seen as more similar to the English. There was a massive treaty between Alfred and a Viking leader, Guthrum, that sort of established the Dane Law, or what mm-hmm. is now known as the Dane Law. And so there was peaceful-ish interaction between the English and the Vikings.
Before I jump out of my head, were they ever considered local? I guess, would they ever have been considered as an Anglo-Saxon or a Mercian? Or would they always just be Danes, I guess?
I have not come across those exact words. They probably, after a few generations, it would be very difficult to distinguish between a Scandinavian who had arrived there and established a farm and the people who had been living there for centuries already. But they do switch between referring to them as like Vikingas or Vikings, and then they'll refer to them as Dane or Danes. They will also refer to the raiding Vikings as Danes or a Danish army, but there is that bit of distinction where you do start to see Dane used in a more neutral context rather than all the negative connotations that Vikingas carries.
Okay. So would that be Vikingas?
Vichingas, yeah.
Vichingas.
Vichinga, WICINGA. Vichinga,
Okay.
yes.
And that would specifically be for raiding Vikings, I guess, who were
Yeah.
causing a little bit of a nuisance, to say the least.
Exactly. And if they were doing it as a group, it was known as a hære, H-E-R-E. And that's a word that existed in the Old English language before the Vikings showed up. So it really just meant a group of like over 35 people that were
Ah,
causing unrest.
man.
And there was way more than 35 people when the Vikings showed up.
Yeah. So they get one word for under 35 and then another for
Yeah, I guess
over.
there's this little document that I found that's it says thieves and people who are being unruly, if they are acting in this many numbers, they are called a band. If they are acting in this many numbers, they are called some other word for group. And if they're, I can't remember if it's 25 or 35, but if it's over that number, if it's that number or higher, then they are a hetera. So they did in the laws, in the actual law codes, they did have distinguish, they did distinguish between the numbers or the size of groups. So like when in 865, a great Viking army shows up in England and they call it the Hære, the Danish Hære, the Danish army, the Mikkjal Hære, like the mighty army or the big army. And
I feel like there's definitely more than 35 there.
oh, there are definitely more than 35.
There's
It's
just
really
like,
hard to say how many there were, and that's been a topic of some dispute among scholars.
there's just one guy there counting, just like
Yeah, he was
counting the little heads as they come off the boats, and was like,
yeah.
yeah, I think there's probably maybe more than 35
There's
here.
probably there's I think there's more than 35. They're like, I can see at least 20 now, so we can assume that there's more than that over that hill. But there, yeah.
I wonder if they had to wait until they physically saw them as well. Though. They was
Just
like, "Oh,
like,
no, we don't know just yet. Let's just wait until we see them."
I wouldn't put it past them, especially the chroniclers. They're pretty finicky. But I think once you see the hordes coming over the shores, you're like, I feel comfortable judging that as over 35.
Yeah, I'm not gonna hang around and see just
Exactly.
how many more than 35 there is.
But yeah, so they're called a hetera or a Mikkjal hetera to refer to that
Okay.
specific great army and its constituents that arrived in, the late 9th century.
So do you think without the Viking invasion, there would ever be like a unified England? Because obviously we still have like a Scotland and a Wales, and there is an England now, but was there much, just to kind of rephrase that as well, to kind of put it all into one, were the kingdoms within England, like Wessex, Mercia, East Anglia, Northumbria, were they as separated as somewhere like Wales and Scotland, or were they still kind of together? But does that make sense? Like, I
Yeah,
get,
that does make sense.
would
Yeah.
Wessex dislike Mercia, or like would there be as much of a divide between them and Mercia and them and Wales?
So I'm trying to think of a good comparison for this. They saw each other as quite different. So they all had pretty different local customs, different dialects, but I think they viewed themselves as pretty culturally similar to each other because they shared a common language and they were all Christian kingdoms.
Okay.
So they had a common religion and a common language, but it would be kind of like, I don't know, you still have a lot of cultural differences between even the north and south of England. So it would be more like that, probably a little bit more starkly divided. But I think because there are different cultural roots and different languages in Wales and Scotland and Ireland, they weren't seen as quite as familiar to them.
Would Wales and Scotland still have been pagan, or would they have been Christianized by?
No, I think I don't know much about Wales and Scotland in the 10th century, but I would assume they'd be pretty Christian by then just because it was kind of pervasive across the island at that point. If anyone wants to correct me on that, they are more than welcome to.
It's always good to say you don't know. I would prefer that over than just being like, it was. Somebody in the chat said Wales and Scotland were Christian before England.
Yeah, that's very possible. I don't know the chronology for their conversion, but that wouldn't surprise me at all. I know they're definitely Christian by the time period that we're talking about, but there were little pockets of pagan practices that had either been assimilated into Christianity or were still practiced in specific localities. But yeah, overall, I'd say they're probably.
Yeah, I was just wondering whether that would maybe make more of a divide if, you know, the other English kingdoms were Christian and they were pagan. Maybe they'd be like, oh, I'm not going
No, I think that the Christianity was widespread enough that it was recognizable to all of them. I think a big one would have been the language.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether you're going to know the answer to this. How come Wales kept a different language, or how come they had, because obviously they're so close, and England is a small island. I guess it's not, I can understand it maybe more with like Sweden and Finland because it's a big geographical mass, whereas England is a very, the UK is a pretty small little island. So do we know why that language didn't just kind of get into Wales?
That's one of my friends from my program would be leaping out of his seat to answer this question, but that's more a linguistic thing. So English is a Germanic language that shares roots with all of the Germanic and modern Scandinavian languages of today. And Old English and Old Norse are actually pretty close. So the Anglo-Saxons and Utes brought their language with them when they came in like the 5th century, I believe. And Wales was not really conquered by them in the same way. And they also weren't really invaded by the Vikings. So the Briton language, which is what Welsh is, was preserved there. And I don't know enough about it to comment on why exactly that was.
Okay.
And there probably was quite a bit of back and forth. I know like King Offa comes into it. So you have Offa's dyke acting as the border. But
I do find that very curious how the Vikings were so active in England and Scotland.
There were quite a few forays into England, and the Vikings were all over like Orkney and the Hebrides and everything.
Yeah, and obviously they will have come down around the north of the UK and down to like the Isle of Man?
Isle of Man, yeah.
Isle of Man. I always get the Isle of Wight mixed up.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the Isle of Man obviously has a ton of Viking history on there, down into Ireland and Dublin. So I kind of find it odd that Wales just didn't kind of get sucked up into all of this.
It could have been ease of access. Someone in the chat just mentioned how it's not as flat as England. So it's easy to hide in the hills. There is a lot of Viking evidence on the, like, especially in place names, on the western coast of Wales, but that's mostly for navigational purposes, not really settlement purposes. So you might find a couple little outposts, but no, not the kinds of massive settlements that you would see in England. So Wales was largely untouched in comparison to its neighbors, but still quite a bit of activity, especially on the borders. I know King Edward's niece, Æthelflæd, she had a lot to do with like foraying into Wales and bringing the Welsh kings to submission.
Okay.
Which is really interesting. So there was interaction and conflict between them that's pretty well recorded, but I do not know enough about the linguistics phenomenons to comment on why Welsh is so well preserved, whereas a Germanic language took over the rest of the island.
This can be a new job for Bob when he's booking another guest, to find somebody who specializes in why Wales. Because, I mean, to be fair, Wales is still quite inaccessible today. Like, they do have it tough because they have like one road into the north. And then to get from the north of Wales to the south, you almost have to like come back out into England and then go down and then back in again. There isn't much access into that middle country. So maybe it is geographical.
It could very well be geographical. I know that's why the Romans had such a hard time with Wales. It took them a while to invade Wales. Also, the Welsh were very good archers.
Yeah. Well, that helps if you're up in the hills.
Yes, it does.
I feel like Wales and Scotland were just tough, and we just took it and we're like,
yeah, you guys are just like, you're flat. You've got all this nice farmland, plenty of coastline to land on. You're not too far from the continent or Scandinavia, really.
Yeah, we're just like, guess we're Saxon now. guess we're Roman now. Oh, we'll be Vikings now, I guess. Oh, Normans, here you come.
Exactly. There we go. So, yeah, everywhere. England's history is really just conquer after conquer after conquer.
And I was once told that... I was once told that England was only ever conquered fully twice. And I don't know whether this is true or not. Once by the Romans and once by the Normans. But I feel like it has to be more than that.
I could see that. I mean, both of those groups established pretty absolute identities in England and shaped their history and kind of connected them to a larger network on the continent. But I don't know, I'd say that the Angles and the Saxons pretty thoroughly conquered.
Yeah, for sure.
But for sure. I mean, they just weren't as unified as the Romans or the Normans. Mm-hmm. So I guess maybe it is accurate to say, because they did kind of split up different regions for different, I don't know, tribes is probably the wrong word, but different groups.
Yeah. Okay. So back to, I guess the question before was, do you think that there would have been a unified England without the Vikings?
That's an excellent question, and one that I tackled in my MPhil dissertation. I think the Vikings definitely acted as a catalyst, at least in early medieval England, to sort of cause them to push for a unified identity and to blur the lines of Northumbrian and Mercian and Wessex or West Saxon and East Anglian, because they had a common enemy. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of King Alfred's vision. And one of the reasons for creating the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle was to give the whole island a common history, like a common secular history, not just an ecclesiastical or a folkloric history. So that was the first notable effort to unify the kingdoms of England into one cohesive identity. But it didn't really come about until after the Normans, so the Vikings kind of fractured it further, distracted everyone from their internecine fightings between the English kingdoms, and then hung around long enough for the Normans to come and kind of sweep the slate clean a little bit. And then after that, a real, in quotes, English identity emerged. But I think that was kind of the first step in moving in that direction.
Okay. Yeah. Because in The Last Kingdom, why'd you pull that face? Alfred, it's all set about Alfred's big thing is that he wants a unified England. And obviously, yeah. I know it's a TV show, but I just wondered whether that was thinking, and I know that I've seen it. The scene attested as like Athelstan is technically the first true individual king of England.
Yeah, there's a lot of first kings of England, and it really depends on what you define as England at that time. But yeah, I'd say Athelstan's a pretty good candidate for that.
Okay.
I think once Northumbria had kind of joined the rest of England, that was considered a unified England. It was under sort of the same top-down control. But that didn't last for very long. So it's not like, oh, Athelstan became king, then England was its own thing, and it's been that way ever since. Because it did fall apart quite a few times, and it did break up and reform a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So did it only really become stable after William the Conqueror invaded?
I think in the sense of what we think of as like a nation today or a national identity, yes. But it's a little bit hard to say because there was so much going on and so many different claims to power over different parts of England before the Norman conquest leading right up to it. It's difficult to consider that unified. So I would say that yes, after the Norman conquest is really when an English identity takes on its form, like the language changes, the writing changes, the systems of governments undergo a lot of change. But it's hard to say that there, I wouldn't feel comfortable making the claim that there's a cohesive England before the Norman conquest.
Isn't it fascinating?
Got close a few times.
Isn't it fascinating that William managed to just kind of do that, just come across and sweep? And because obviously, you know, the Vikings had been trying for generations and generations to conquer England. And I guess each individual kingdom within England had also been trying to, I guess there's always power wars between the different kingdoms, and they'll be trying to steal bits of land, conquer each other. You know, kings are ambitious, but it seems like William just came in and with brutality swept up through England, burning villages, and was just like, you all belong to me now, but managed to do it.
I have sadly not learned as much about the Norman conquest itself as I would like to. I know more about the lead up and the aftermath, but it's fascinating that he was able to come in and just do such a clean sweep of everything. And of course it wasn't as simple as that, but he was fighting against, you know, the English quote unquote natives, the incumbent populace, and the Vikings and Viking kings who thought that they had claim to England as well, who were coming directly over from Scandinavia to fight and reinforce their relatives who had settled in England.
Yeah.
And then you had figures like King Canute, who was a Danish king, but he was really an English king before he was anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. it just gets so messy leading up to the conquest. And then,
I guess it was almost like perfect place, perfect time. You know, you had the Battle of Stamford Bridge, where you had King Harold's army had fought a battle and then had to come all the way back down to Hastings. You had, it's almost like a perfect storm.
Yeah.
And probably like generations of infighting in England is just, you know, it takes its toll. And I'm sure soldiers become depleted. Soldiers, you know, you have to wait for people to, because as macabre as it is, you kind of have to wait for people to become of age so they can fight again.
Die.
Yeah, if you have a bunch of people die in a war, you kind of have to wait for that to replenish. And as cruel as that sounds, it's
very
how
true.
It was.
Yeah, it was in a pretty weakened state, and it had come close to cohesion and unity, or whatever you want to call it, a couple times under different kings. But yeah, when Guillaume le Conquérant showed up, he just really cleaned house. And there's a lot of speculation that there was some understanding between who was it? I guess it would have been Edward the Martyr, because he had familial connections, I think, on both sides to William the Conqueror.
Okay.
But don't quote me on that. But there is some speculation about the, like, maybe it was a bit of an inside job. Maybe there was some understanding between William and whatever ruling Saxon or Anglo-Saxon power there was at the time of the conquest, or just before the conquest, that made it easier for him to come in.
Well, apparently Edward the Confessor promised him it on his throne. Apparently, his ship was. I think he was on a trip or a voyage to northern France, and his ship became shipwrecked. And William pulled them and saved them out of the water. And he promised him that on his deathbed he would be the next king of England. But I think that fucker was promising everyone it. There was
He
like,
really was. There was some.
he was a right hussy with that throne. He was just giving it out.
You get to be the next king of England, and you get to be the next king of
He caused a
England.
right mess because he's like, it was Harold Godwinson on his deathbed. He's like,
Yes.
you're my buddy, you're going to be the next king of England. So, and he just, yeah, he seemed to just cause a real struggle there.
Yeah, so I think that probably made it a bit easier for William in the end, since
Yeah.
there was so much fighting over the throne already. There wasn't a clear inheritor.
Yeah, for sure.
At least
But
everyone felt like they had a claim to it.
yeah. So was there much push for like a united country prior? As in like were because there must have been like battles between the different kingdoms. Or was it really when the Vikings started to take a hold that people kind of thought, oh, maybe we need to band together against a common enemy?
So there are always attempts to gain more territory for your own kingdom, and there were alliances and there were marriages that would kind of unify certain kingdoms under certain circumstances. But really, the biggest push was when the Vikings showed up and they were like, look at these pagan, non-English speaking assholes burning our villages and destroying all of our stuff. They're not of us. They are invaders. We need to rally around and go face them in battle together. And
I feel like as a human species, we need space Vikings to come and make us realize that
I think it would help.
we're all just a human species and that like the
Yeah, they're
geographical
like,
position you're from, the skin color you are,
well,
the
Wessex
sex you
isn't
are, doesn't
that
really
different
matter.
from Mercia. Yeah,
Yeah.
so it did, having a common enemy definitely helped. And that's a pretty common thing that you see in the formation of a lot of communities, is you'll have disparate communities who other their neighboring communities. And then once something more threatening and more different shows up, those communities bond together and they see themselves as a team.
I think was it an American president who said like, oh, we could do with like an alien invasion, or it was something along those lines, in a sense of that, because people wouldn't care who was black, white, male, female, because we would then be like, oh, well, we're one human species now, and we have this threat that is different to us. It's that bigger, like you said, that bigger other threat, and nothing that brings people together and makes you realize that there's not much difference until that happens.
Exactly, until
Ali
you
said it was in the Independence Day movie. No,
yes.
I'm pretty sure there was a real, I'm sure there was, it wasn't a fictional president. I feel like it was a president who actually said it, I think.
Oh,
Possibly.
I wouldn't be surprised.
I'm not 100% sure now. So, if somebody would like to Google that and just prove me right, that would be very nice. But I'm completely not sure now.
That was the biggest push. Alfred also tried to standardize the language, or at least make all of England more literate by translating ecclesiastical texts that had been written in Latin into Old English. And then really promote literacy and kind of make what could be interpreted as early signs of a print culture to unify his people. He also started referring to people as Engelkin or English kind. And that there are a couple other instances before Alfred of that word being used, but he really started pushing for it. And so he essentially gave them, like, reminded them of their common religion and the commonalities, reminded them of their common language and made it more accessible, and then gave them a team name, essentially.
So do you think that's why in programs like The Last Kingdom that they attribute this big idea of a united England to Alfred?
Probably. And it wasn't just him. He drew a lot on ideas that were very similar that had come before him. Like, take Bede, for example. He wrote his the title of his one of his best known works is the Ecclesiastical History of the English People. So Historia Ecclesiastica de Gens Anglorum. So he says Gens Anglorum, like the English kind, the English gens, the English people. And then Alfred used a lot of his ideas to kind of support his own ideas of an English people, of a gens Anglorum. He just called it Anglican to use the old English and further promote the vernacular.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wonderful. So Ali, just to jump in here, so people don't think I'm crazy, Ali said that it was Reagan in a speech at the UN in 1987.
There you go. Well done.
She even gave me the quote. So perhaps we need some outside universal threat to make us recognize the common bond. I paraphrased. See? Space Vikings.
Well,
Space
done.
Vikings.
I didn't know that.
I probably just heard it on another podcast, to be fair. I'm just regurgitating. So who do you... Here's an interesting question. Who do you think came closer to making a United Kingdom prior to the Norman invasion, the Vikings or the English? Because it seems like they just kind of threw it back between themselves.
Yeah, as I understand it, the Vikings weren't really too interested in uniting. Like they had understandings between groups. They had this whole power axis between Ireland and England, and they were constantly going back and forth across the Irish Sea. And there was a lot of traffic between England and Scandinavia, or the, you know, the island in Scandinavia. So they were kind of spread out and kind of loosely enough connected that if they wanted to take more territory, they could band together and cooperate and go do that. But for the most part, I don't think they were trying to push for a unified, established, cohesive kingdom the way that Alfred was.
So how come you end up with Canute being claimed as a king of England?
Oh gosh, that is very complicated.
Okay, we've got time.
Okay, so this is a bit later than my speciality, but
you should have known coming in that there was no way that I was only going to stay on topic.
I know, but okay. That's a great question. So Canute had familial ties because I'm pretty sure he was the son of Svein Forkbeard.
Brilliant name. Never heard that before. Right? Fantastic name.
Yeah.
Can't imagine for a second how he got that name. He probably just wore beads in his beard, and people are like,
probably. And he's like, yeah, cool. Your
beard looks like Forkbeard.
I mean, they had pretty cool epithets back in the day. My favorite is still Ethelred the Unready.
I know. I'd be so devastated if that was mine. And that's it for history now. Like, you get Eric Bloodaxe. Like, fuck yeah, he's got a bloody axe. He must have killed, everybody. Wow, what a dude. And then you just got, the Unready thing.
The Unready. So interesting. The old English name for that was Ethelred Unradh, which just directly translates to ill-advised.
Okay.
Or the unadvised. So, but Rad has kind of shifted semantically to mean prepared or ready.
Okay.
Instead of advised. So when you look at the Old English, there's not as much blame pointed as him. It's his advisors who didn't do their jobs very well. But yeah, Ethelred the Unready is a great one.
He's stuck with it now. Like Ali pointed out again in the chat, my Viking name somehow ended up being Dan the Dick Biter, because I once said that if war was happening, then you gotta do what you gotta do, and if you're in a position where you're fighting and it's there, it's getting you just gotta bite it off, haven't you? Like, that's just I must have said this. I said this so long ago, and somehow it's just stuck. So I guess that's kind of how this thing happens. So if I was, you know, we were back in the 10th century.
Yeah.
There would be some idiot on a podcast 1,000 years later referring to me as the Dick Biter.
Yeah, there you go. Now you know how Ethelred feels.
Yeah, so the Space Vikings in 500 years are going to be like,
there you go.
This Dick Biter guy. That's a bit.
How did that happen?
Yeah, how did. I wonder. He was the worst thing is, let's just say, through some weird series of events, that all technology got lost. So they couldn't like hear the episodes, but somehow the Dick Biter like name carried on forth through generations. And they must be just be like, oh, that guy must have bit a lot of dicks. Like there's like he must have like really
so many dicks to be known as Dan Dick Biter.
Yeah, he must have like really, really like got in there on that.
He was just chomping away.
Oh yeah. So if someone made a runestone and we just left it somewhere, just for the future generations. That would be
Oh, that would be wonderful.
But I obviously we joke about this, but I always wonder like if that's happened in history. It must have.
I'm sure it has. I mean, you see tons of Roman graffiti that's like for a good time, visit this person's house, or so and so was here, or so and so loves, I don't know, another person. But it's so and also just scratchings of the good old cock and balls can be found everywhere in ancient graffiti.
Men
everyone
never grow
was
up.
Strong dicks. So men I'm sure they said, I'm sure they said some pretty hilarious things, and it's now recorded somewhere in an archive.
I mean, because obviously a sense of humor, it's as the old as time, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they were always, people were always just playing tricks on each other. And I've always wondered, I wonder what the thing is that we, not even just relating to the Vikings, like as a, just a history as a whole, the mm-hmm. thing that like humans take to be today, to be like really serious that we take as being fact, that the people at the time are just like, oh my God, that's definitely not what that was. That's not what that meant. That actually meant like, that was just a joke. Like I was just playing a prank on him. And then, but somehow it's just become this amazing find that we all now look at and revere as this super important
thing. I think about that all the time, and it must have be so funny to think about that. And it makes you wonder what that is going to be in the future. Like, are people going to look back at our memes?
Oh yeah.
A lot of questions.
Oh my God. There's some bad memes out there. That yeah, because obviously it just depends on what makes it through to that next stage and what, you know, what survives. And it could be, it must be tough if, you know, if you make a discovery to then be like, oh, this could actually just be a joke. Because I'm sure everybody that makes like a big find is like, they want it to be like the most serious, like groundbreaking find ever, because that's just human nature. So, and then it's just a little bit of a joke.
It's just, they're just having us on.
I feel like it has to have happened. Must have.
I'm positive it has. There's no way that we've avoided that.
Yeah. Not even just with jokes. I feel like it would be so fascinating if you could just pull somebody from back then. But again, it's that question of like, probably depending on which region you pulled them from would depend on which answer you'd get. But
yeah, that's very true.
If you could just pull someone back and be like, this is what we think, like, are we close? And I just feel like they'd just be like, no, not at all.
You're like, not at all. No, they're like, I love that any unknown object found that they can't classify or identify is often classified as a ritual object or a cult item or a religious artifact. And I mm-hmm. wonder how many things that were, you know, like, oh, that's not an idol, that's a shoehorn or something, have been ascribed really significant meaning that had a completely prosaic function.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, it was just a little ornament, like silly little ornament that they made for.
Yeah,
like, there must be things that, yeah, or things that like a husband might make for a wife, or his wife might just make for him. And you know, people are individuals. They have personalities. They will have done things a little bit different. And some are lazy, some aren't. Some are specialized in things, some don't. So you just get this whole array of things. And I always find it quite, I find this with textiles a lot, when you get reenactment groups who get really finicky about like the amount of stitches you have to have or this. And I always just think like, you know what? people are people. They didn't have like a little thing that said you had to have 10 stitches. It was, some people will have done 8 because they're fucking lazy like me, and some will have done it like perfect.
It's very true, and that variation can be seen across any sect of history that you want to examine. And it makes it really hard to project things back and say, this is historically accurate, this is not historically accurate. Because as Matthias loves to remind his classes, it's complicated and we can't go ask them about it.
Has he stole that for his classes, or did we steal that from his classes?
You probably stole that from his classes.
Probably, yeah. He probably just said it on here, and I was like, ooh. He probably just said it all the time on here, to be fair.
And then anytime anyone asked a question in class, he'd go, well, it's complicated. And he'd give his answer.
Let's kind of not, we have to wrap up just yet, but let's, how is Matthias as a teacher? What's he like?
He's wonderful. He is hilarious. I remember, maybe I shouldn't tell the story, but one time, March 18th, we showed up to class and Matthias was sitting at his desk, just looking absolutely miserable. And this was for my Tolkien Nordic Sources in the Lord of the Rings class. And he was sitting at his desk with his head on his hands, not looking at anyone. And he said, okay, class, get in discussion groups. You're going to discuss the chapters you read for the next 50 minutes.
Okay.
Why? And he's like, yesterday was St. Patrick's Day and I woke up covered in green glitter in a dumpster. Don't talk to me.
I feel, I can see that.
He would, I wouldn't say he often showed up to class in such a state, but that was one very memorable bit. That was the first class I ever had with him.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, so clearly I took 5 more classes with him. But yeah, as a teacher, he's really wonderful. He's so funny. He's so engaged with the material. He's very approachable as a professor. We recently went through and read all of his ratings on Rate My Professor, and a lot of people have a lot of complaints about his grading. So I never found him to be a harsh grader, but apparently a lot of people think he is.
I imagine he is. I don't know if I should bring this up, but I did read his review of A Children of Ash and Elm.
It's scathing.
So I can imagine that his reviewing is quite particular.
Yeah.
So
I was a decent student, so I never saw that side of him. But I was his last resort student, so I always did the reading because I'm a huge fucking nerd and I love school, which is why I'm doing masters. And he would never call on me. I'd be sitting there with my hand raised after he asked a question for a good 30 seconds. Like, I'm losing feeling in my arm and he's still not calling on me. And then if nobody else in the class would answer, he would ask me to respond to the question. But it was the most frustrating thing as one of his students, because I had done the work.
But that's the thing. He will have known that you knew the answer, and he's like, please,
so I was
someone
he
else.
Called his last resort student, because he's like, I can always count on you, Amina. You always do the reading.
Oh, yeah.
Like, okay, thanks. But yeah, so that was fun. And I know that is a good system, but at the time it was very annoying.
No, because you want to show off your...
I want to show off. I'm just like, let's move on. I can answer this question and then we can move on to the next part of class. Let's go.
If it was me, I would be showing off. I'd be like, ooh, I know it. I've done that on this podcast so many times with Matthias. I'm like, ooh, I know this answer. Let me answer it quick. Just sat here with my little hand up.
Oh, it's fun.
So, is there anything else glaringly obvious that we've missed from English identity that we need to know? It seems as though we owe a lot to the Normans when it comes to actually getting that unified identity.
Yeah, that was really the catalyst for a very clean unification, but the catalyst for the idea and the necessity of an English identity did come about during sort of the late 9th, early 10th century. And then even later than that, in the 19th century, is when people started looking back at these early medieval sources and ascribing the deeper English history to that, and kind of making a cohesive national narrative about your origins and your history. So there, it went through many phases to get to where it is today. What it meant to be English has undergone a lot of transformation.
Yeah. I wouldn't, even as an Englishman, I wouldn't really know what it means to be English. I feel like we've done, we're kind of one of those countries, or we're definitely one of those countries, that's done enough to other countries where we're not allowed to be like proud of being English
That's
anymore.
Fair.
You know, like there are certain countries around the world. America's certainly one of them. Maybe Denmark's one of them. I don't know. They've done a lot. Belgium, the Netherlands. You know, there's certain countries who've conquered, colonized, whatever word you want to use, enough people that now, like, I feel like English pride would automatically be synonymous with the far right.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. It's unfortunate. And sadly, a lot of the ideology around nation building and national identity was co-opted by white supremacists and Nazis and that whole group in you know, the 19th and 20th centuries.
Yeah, you get them looking back, like white supremacists looking back favorably on that time period, because you have, is it WASP?
Yeah,
that's like white Anglo-Saxon and proud,
yeah.
or white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, is it?
Yeah, and it's weird because even the term Anglo-Saxon is so difficult. So we kind of use it as a catch-all for less an ethnic group and more people who are living in a certain place at a certain time.
Yeah, but
but
it's
it's
just,
been used to mean a certain race or a certain ethnicity, and it's, yeah, it's,
I feel like it's almost used as like a time before. So for those people, it'd be like a time before these other people came here. I feel like that's kind of, they don't really care accurately what an Anglo-Saxon is. It's kind of just that it was before this happened.
Yes.
But then they don't really, they kind of miss the irony of they also came here.
Yeah, absolutely.
The
Yeah,
Saxons.
They didn't
Saxons
pop
kind of,
off the ground.
Yeah, the Saxons weren't just like born here. They kind of came from Saxony.
Exactly. Yeah, Saxony, the Jutland, where or Jutland, as Matthias says, the Utes came, and they're the ones who took over Kent and a lot of southern England. The Angles were part of that whole, you know, northern Germanic group as well. So yeah, there are all these continental people coming over to England after the Romans vacated. So it's, yeah, it's not really clear. And it's often kind of glossed over how many waves of, you know, immigrants there were that formed the England that we know today.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, how a certain immigration is like cool, and then a certain other immigration isn't by some people. It's like, it's like, do you not fucking see the irony? You see the ignorance that they don't know, or they just choose not
to. Yeah, or
to.
they choose to ignore it. Yeah, there's a lot of hypocrisy and a lot of cherry picking of history to fit certain narratives.
Yeah, it is. And to be fair, they're not the smartest people in the world, so I wouldn't expect. I wouldn't expect them to kind of pick up on irony.
Yeah.
So is there anything missing? Do you think we should cover before we Q&A?
I think that's it. Yeah. I mean, as you've seen, it's pretty complicated. So I hope you're happy with yourself.
No, I am. I feel like I've learned a lot. I've learned what the
Good. I'm very
Anglo-Saxon
glad.
Chronicles are.
Yep.
Yeah. No. This has been a lot of fun, and we will jump over and do the Q&A again. I know I bang on it a lot at the minute, but you can get the Q&A bonus episode over on our Patreon. It's Nordic Mythology Patreon. Sorry, forward slash nordicmythologypodcast. You get that bonus episode every week, and you can ask your questions prior or live, like a lot of people do. I'll just go through the live chat and we hang out a little bit further. But yeah, this has been a lot of fun. You know, I said before the podcast that I'd done a little bit of soul searching over the last couple of weeks, how I felt like it's no secret to a lot of people listening to podcasts, I've had a tumultuous 18 months. And I certainly feel like I've just been kind of just going along with the motions, like, you know, floating, bobbing along for the last few months. And it took a little bit of soul searching, looking kind of where I want to go with the podcast to really kind of realize that, you know, I love doing this. It's so much fun. But I probably, if I'm very honest with myself, lost a little bit of that fire into wanting to get here. And, you know, doing it in the unit is never very easy. Having like a nice little setup at home is always preferable. So hopefully that's where I'm going to be in the next couple of weeks. But, you know, it took a little bit, like I said, a little bit of a look in the mirror to be like, you know what, you've not been putting in as much effort maybe as you should do. And I feel like it started with the episode with Jameson where, mm-hmm. you know, we just sat and we just had a laugh. I felt more myself in that episode and more like the old podcast of just being able to have a little giggle. And I feel like that's carried on in the last couple of episodes with Genevieve and then with you. It's just it's more fun. I feel like we went quite serious with wanting to go down the scholarly route, which I like, but I feel like I just kind of was present, but not properly present. And it's one of those things that you kind of have to, it's tough to admit sometimes that you've been, you know, a little, I don't know if lazy is the right word, but kind of just there, but not really there.
Right. Well, as you said, just going through the motions.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, complacent, perfect word. Yes. Everybody listening probably thinks Ali's the only person watching because she's just been hitting the nail on the head. Yeah, complacent. I feel like I have been, and that's shown with across the board, like behind the scenes as well. So it's kind of, I guess, saying this publicly when you put it out there kind of holds you to the sword as well. Yes. You know, it's my kind of commitment to push on and do better, because I do enjoy doing this. I think we've built a beautiful community and we can really kind of keep it going for a long time. It's just, you know, I appreciate everyone that's stayed listening, stayed supporting throughout the last 18 months. And now I really do feel like I'm kind of out of the other side. I'm like, I've got the house, I'm a little bit more settled. Everything's kind of getting there, that I feel like it's over the hill and I can start kind of appreciating these moments a little bit more.
Good. Well, it means a lot to finally be on this. I've seen so much of the behind the scenes mm-hmm. with Matthias and when Shan was doing the editing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to be on the other side of things now. And it's really an honor. So thank you for having me on, Dan.
You're welcome. It was a lot of fun. Like I say, these are the episodes I enjoy, where we can have a rapport, have a laugh. Obviously, we met at Midgasplot, not this year, the year before. I knew straight away that we were going to have a laugh, and we'd be able to talk easy. And that's what excites me. I enjoy that learning, but also just having, just being a little bit silly. And I think I've missed that. I've probably just kind of, like I said, just gone with it. Just kind of done, as difficult as it is to probably admit, just done the minimum to get through each episode. Kind of just like, teed the question up, let the guests speak, and then think of another question, let them speak, rather than actively like feeling engaged and feeling that kind of back and forth. So mm-hmm. and I'm sure it comes across in the episode, so this is kind of a turning point where we can kick on. We're doing some wonderful things behind the scenes and putting together some ideas that we're going to do some new little bits and segments and episodes. So yeah, watch this space. There's my little heartfelt apology, I guess, as well, as much as anything, to people that listen. You know, it's not been kind of what I've been wanting to put out. You know, just been not really been myself, I guess. So yeah, there's a little apology to people. But yeah, where can people find you? If they want to follow you.
If they want to follow me, they can follow my Instagram, which is Waelhref, Waelhref. You can friend me on Facebook.
I did that to Mateus. I was like, everyone just add Mateus the week after he deleted Facebook. So
I'm a millennial, so I'm shackled perpetually to the engines of social media. So
yeah,
Instagram's a really good place to find me. I don't post very much, but there are some, if you want to see the actual manuscript of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, the oldest one, the Parker Chronicle, my supervisor at Cambridge did take me to go see it. And so there's a very cheesy picture of me with the manuscript on a pillow, looking like I'm, you know, meeting my hero. But it was very cool.
That's good. Wonderful. Okay, if you want to follow me personally, it's Daniel_Farrand1. Obviously, you can support the business, which is just at Horns of Odin or hornsofodin.com. And like I said at the start of the show, either if you can support us on Patreon, it's patreon.com/NordicMythologyPodcast, or just leave us a 5-star rating, a positive review wherever you get your podcast. And follow the podcast on all the little social media. So me for the millennials. Yeah, the little somies. I don't know if you meant to actually say that or just type it, but the somies.
I've never heard that before. I feel old.
Okay, let's do the Q&A.
Yeah.